WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Actor John Lithgow made his movie breakthrough wearing nail polish, eyelashes, prosthetic breasts, and support hose. His portrayal of the transsexual in The World According to Garp earned him his first Academy Award nomination. Lithgow is one of today's most versatile stage and screen actors. You probably also remember his performances as the panicked airline passenger in Twilight Zone the movie, the shy banker in Terms of Endearment, the psychopathic murderer in Blowout, and the fundamentalist preacher in Footloose. Today, Lithgow is back on the stage, where he got his start. He's starring in the Broadway hit M. Butterfly. It's based on the true story of a French diplomat's bizarre 20-year affair with a Beijing opera diva, an affair that ended in sexual and political betrayal. I spoke with John Lithgow from the NPR Bureau in New York about his movie career, but first I asked him to describe his role in M. Butterfly.
I play a character called René Gallimard, who's a French diplomat. The form of the play, I begin the play sitting in prison, convicted for treason, and I sort of spin the tale for the audience. I tell the story of myself 20 years earlier when I was posted in Peking in the French embassy and fell in love with a Peking opera star, singer, and carried on a 20-year-long liaison with her, not knowing, number one, that she was a spy, and number two, that she was a man. That's this kind of astounding premise to this play. And I'm an embittered old man, but I tell the story of myself as a sort of foolish, innocent young man. So, in a way, it's two characters.
As the actor in this role, do you have to convince yourself that there's a way that this character could have had this mistress and not known that the she was really a man?
Well, I sort of have to do that as an actor, but David Huang, the playwright, has answered a lot of those questions. It sounds like a completely impossible premise, and I suppose it is, but watching the play has its own plausibility. As you proceed along, you just buy in more and more to this extraordinary deception. That was my response to the play, reading it, and I think that's the response to the audience, seeing it. They can't believe that they're going along with it, and yet they do.
You know, throughout your career, you've acted on the stage. You've done a lot of movies and television, but you keep going back to the stage, and that's also where you started. I think there's a certain thrill that audiences get when they see an actor who they know from the movies, and I wonder if you've been experiencing that now that you're so much better known than you were when you started in the theater.
Oh, yeah, very much so. That's one of the good things about doing films. It gives you such clout on stage. I mean, I remember that myself when I was much younger. I remember seeing Alec Guinness on stage and Dylan and Richard Burton playing Hamlet. There is just an extraordinary feeling to being in the same building with somebody that you've seen on screen. It's pretty rudimentary stuff, but God knows I take advantage of it.
You know what I'd like to do? I'd like to talk about some of the roles that really first got you noticed in movies.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe play some clips from a few of them and talk about what you did to prepare for them. Would that be okay?
That's fine.
Good. Let's start with the role that I think people really, really noticed you for. And that's in The World According to Garp, when you played the transsexual who had been a linebacker and then through surgery became a woman. And Roberta Muldoon was the character's name. Let's hear a clip from that movie.
Sure you can stay?
No, I have to go have a heartbreak in Manhattan. He's young, he's handsome. Oh, what can I do?
Maybe this time it'll work out.
Maybe so. I'm a hopeless romantic in a male chauvinist world. Bye, darlings.
What were some, that's a really great scene, great performance. What were some of the gender questions you had to think about playing a man who had become a woman?
Well, I suppose I had to imagine myself going through all that. Playing Roberta, everybody's always figured that this was the hardest thing I'd ever done. In fact, it was one of the easiest. Roberta Muldoon is, I always approach the character as a very simple and ordinary person who, in fact, was more at home with herself than she had been before her sex change operation. I I decided, on the basis of not really much research, but just thinking about it, that if I myself were to change myself into a woman, I wouldn't be all that different. There's a big difference between transsexuals and transvestites. Transvestites are crazy about all the affectations of femininity, but transsexuals are very down to earth. They're very ordinary. They're not that different from the way they were before. Just a little more contented. At least that was my approach to Roberta. I had done a lot of unwitting research years before. I'd just been kind of captivated by Jan Morris.
The writer and transsexual.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Had seen her interviewed quite often, had read her memoir, Conundrum, which really recorded the whole process of undergoing this change and all her thoughts before and afterwards. So just inadvertently, I knew a lot about this issue. It came in handy when I screen tested with George Roy Hill, because the screen test was nothing more than a conversation on the subject of my history in the character of Roberta Muldoon.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
You once said that playing this character was like conducting a prolonged illicit affair with yourself. It was pretty funny.
Well, it was a sexy experience for sure. I don't know, I was in drag for 3 months, and it's a very provocative experience. I recommend it to everyone.
Why?
It just sort of expands your consciousness. What can I tell you? It was very exciting. You felt like a spy behind enemy lines. I hung out with women all the time, and I felt very secret, like this secret heterosexual, a fox among the pigeons.
You know, another thing I find very interesting about this role is that, you know, you're a very tall man, and the character is a former football player, but the character is very emotionally vulnerable. Now, I think in our culture we associate physical strength with emotional strength, and you had to have physical strength but emotional vulnerability in the role.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was this blend of male and female. I think that's true. George himself, the director, had a lot of qualms about casting me in the role because I was so big. And I always thought that was my greatest asset in the role. It sort of was automatically hilarious and moving all at the same time.
Let's go on to another role. My guest is actor John Lithgow. And I'm sure you also remember him in the movie anthology of The Twilight Zone, where he played a passenger on a plane who was terrified, absolutely terrified of flying. And here he is on a plane that's trapped in a storm. He looks out the window, and he thinks he sees a little monster on the wing putting out one of the engines. A pilot comes and tries to calm him down.
Either calm down, or we're going to handcuff you.
Listen, there's something wrong with this airplane. I don't care what happens to me, but if somebody doesn't do something about it, we're all going to die. That's D-I-E, darling.
You big silly. You used to be a normal person.
Sit down, darling. Come on, okay?
Valentine, what do you think's wrong with this aircraft?
There's an engine out.
Which one?
The one on the outside. Outboard number one. It's out, isn't it?
What did you think about to get that out of control, to get that panicky?
This is great. I got to see these movies again.
I had so much fun watching them all again.
Well, I haven't seen them in years. I just sort of worked myself into a state physically. It was a very intense, like, 10-day shoot. So day to day, I was my voice was all raw and I was a physical wreck. And I just kind of exploited that. My research for this part, it was sort of twofold. I have a very good friend, another actor, who is very afraid of flying, and I always knew that, but I'd never known the details of it, and I phoned him long distance in New York and just asked him to talk about it and answered questions, and he told me the most extraordinary things, almost all of which I managed to physicalize and put into that performance. Just as an example, he said in an airplane he's very conscious as he walks down the aisle when it's up in the air not to put too much weight on one side or the other because he's afraid he'll flip the plane over, which sounds hilarious to us, and he knows it's absurd, but yet he walks like a tightrope down that aisle. And if you see the movie again, that's just how I chose to walk. And there was also a remarkable woman, who teaches flight attendants, and she was there as a consultant all the time. And everything I did, I would ask her, am I going too far? And she said, never, never, never. She said, this is nothing to what I've seen.
You know, watching your performance in that film again really made me think about what a very plastic face you have. You can really just totally manipulate your face.
I do have a plastic face, as a matter of fact. No, not really.
No, well, but you can make your eyes pop. You can do things with your cheeks. And,
well, everybody can. I'm the only one who has the nerve.
I want to ask you one other thing about the Twilight Zone movie. In one of the episodes that you weren't in and that you had nothing to do with, there was a terrible accident that we all remember. Vic Morrow and two children were killed in a helicopter bombing accident. Did that really shake you up? Not only the deaths, the tragic deaths of these people, but really like knowing that making make-believe can have tragic real-life consequences.
Well, it was awful, and it was always like a shadow cast over that whole project, even though it was virtually a separate film that happened 2 months before we worked on it.
Oh, that was before your...
Oh, long before, yeah. They were even considering scrapping the whole project, but then they picked it all up again with an entirely new crew. But, you know, we never quite forgot that this terrible thing had happened. I tell you, movie making is so astoundingly dangerous. This is just the most prominent instance, but it just happens all the time. Somehow, something kicks in. You think you're invulnerable when you start acting. It's happened to me all the time on stage. I've really damaged myself over and over again.
What kind of risks have you taken on stage?
Oh, just leaping around. I've twisted my ankle. I've cut my thumb open. This sort of crazy kinetic energy kicks in. And I think it happens with directors, too. They are moving pieces around, and their adrenaline is pumping. They're seeing nothing but the drama of it, and they just hurl things forward. That's why, you know, stuntmen, safety organizations, things like that, they're so incredibly important, because it's like unleashing all these unmanageable emotions and actions and machines. It was only a matter of time before something really notorious and obvious happened. But bad things are happening all the time, and you know, very close, near misses, even though there's a very heightened consciousness because of that accident.
Yeah.
Still terrible risks are taken.
So has it made you more cautious as an actor?
No.
You still have to feel invulnerable to really put out.
Well, it's not that you have to. You just do. Yeah, once you start acting, it's like you don't give a thought to anything. I don't know if you've seen M. Butterfly, but I hurl myself down this ramp at one point, and I can't quite believe I do that every night. But when the moment comes, I just, bam, go ahead and do it.
Are you wearing padding or anything?
I look like a hockey player underneath my clothes. Yes.
I want to play another role that helped make you famous, and this
great.
Is from...
Great, this is a lot of fun.
Now, this is from Terms of Endearment, where you played a bank officer who's very shy and very straight, and he's beginning an affair with the character played by Deborah Winger.
Emma, I haven't made love to a woman in almost 3 years.
How come?
My wife has a disc problem, and she can't take having any weight on her.
Sam, I hope you don't mind me asking you this, but have you ever thought of your wife getting on top?
Oh, she wouldn't do that.
She may surprise you.
No, I don't think so. It would be so unlike her.
Did you ask?
About 600 times.
That's a great scene. I love the way you speak in that scene. You have this very quiet and unsure speaking style in it. You know,
mm-hmm.
And a very slight, I don't know, Midwestern accent?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, he was supposed to be a Hawkeye, you know, and I'm a Buckeye. So I just sort of looked back into my past.
Was it easy to kind of get that insecurity?
Oh, effortless in my case.
Not a big stretch.
No, it was an interesting experience because I was really hurled into it. It was a case of recasting. They they called me in, you know, like with a day's notice. I learned my words for that part on a jet plane, a private Paramount jet flying out to Nebraska in the middle of the night. And, you know, 12 hours later, I was playing the part with Deborah. There was absolutely no preparation, so insecurity was part of the bargain.
Oh, so you mean in this role, the insecurity was especially evident.
Yeah.
You know, you also in that performance captured the gratitude that this character would feel for Deborah Winger, for allowing herself to have this affair with him.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was an interesting way of interpreting it.
Well, it's all there in the writing. I mean,
mm-hmm,
it's beautifully written that way. I mean, that was indeed my approach. I listening to it just now, this is such a memory lane for me. But that scene is so hilarious and so touching all at the same time.
It is very touching, that's right.
And I think that's Jim Brooks' particular genius, but it's also the kind of acting that I'm very fond of, where at any given moment, a scene can just sort of tip one way or the other.
Well, you see, that, I think that really is part of your gift in Twilight Zone, too. I mean, you're really panicking watching this character panicking, but it's also funny.
Yeah, that's right.
But you really play it both ways.
And that's the charge, is finding that little moment where you can pull the string one way or the other. Make them laugh in the middle of panic or cry in the middle of laughter, you know. Just surprise them.
Now, I just want to play a short excerpt from your latest movie. This is the latest movie that was released, Harry and the Hendersons.
Mm-hmm.
And this is about a family who takes a camping trip, and they've accidentally killed what appears to be the Bigfoot. And they take him home thinking that he's dead, and they want to kind of show the evidence of what had happened. But he comes to life, so your character calls the police.
Mm-hmm.
Look, I hit a Bigfoot with my car. I thought it was dead. But I was going to call in the morning, but he must have been hungry because I found it in the kitchen.
Hit a Bigfoot with
no!
your car.
Yes.
In your kitchen.
Look, I'm under a lot of stress here. I mean, it wasn't anymore. I must have just walked into the kitchen. It was eating out of our refrigerator. I thought it was going to eat me, but it ate my daughter's corsage instead. And then I passed it for days, and then it ate our goldfish.
And where is it now, Mr. Henderson?
It's in the bathroom.
Was it any coincidence that you... I forget how many children you've had recently.
So do I.
But was it any coincidence that you were doing a family film at a time when your family had grown?
That was very much a factor in wanting to do the movie. I've done a couple of things with my kids in mind. They're very blasé about it.
You know, sure, right.
They can take it or leave it, but I give them 3 months of my life. You know, the Santa Claus movie and the Twilight. Harry and I even did one of Shelley Duvall's fairy tale theater pieces. It's fun. But it's hard work. You have to take it very seriously, doing family entertainment or kids entertainment.
Yeah, sure. Well, I want to talk with you more about your acting and about your life, but first we have to take a short break. My guest is actor John Lithgow, who's now starring on Broadway in M. Butterfly. This is Fresh Air. John Lithgow is my guest. You know, I think it's fair to say that one of the things that you're best known and most respected for is your versatility, your ability to take on such a wide range of roles, as we've just heard in the clips that we've played. Is that something that you've planned, or is that something that's kind of happened through what you've decided to accept and what you've decided to reject in the roles you've been offered?
Well, I think the latter. I think it's really a result of my background in the theater. I mean, I grew up. The first acting I ever did was working for my dad, who was a producer of regional theater, mostly the classics and mostly Shakespeare festivals out in Ohio. And I worked with him. I would apprentice summers and play all the kind of utility character parts in Shakespeare plays. I never played anything big.
I like the utility parts.
That's right. Well, it was, you know, things like Froth and Nim and Pinch and Hortensio and the Second Musician, all these kind of throwaway parts that have to be, that are usually played by skinny teenage kids. But I mean, my great thrill was every week doing a new makeup and a new accent and stretching myself in different directions. And my first few years as a professional in the theater was working at places like the McCarter Theater in Princeton for my dad, or Long Wharf, a new play every week, or a new play every month, always the fun of it was always, let me be as different this time as I can be. And in a way, my movie career and my theater career has just been an extension of that. You don't get that opportunity in the films very often. And the fact that my sort of breakthrough performances in the film were in such quick succession and so very different, that sort of liberated me. And it's made people think of me this way. I feel very lucky.
I read an article that you wrote for Film Comment, and you said something that I really love that I'd like to just quote here. You said, acting is such intense and emotionally involving work that you cannot do it well without thinking that you're working on something great and important, and that's why actors are so often deluded about the worth of a project. Do you feel that you've ever fooled yourself in the middle of a role?
Constantly.
Really?
Constantly, yeah. You not only do you fool yourself, but you have terrible doubts. You fool yourself both ways. Sometimes you fool yourself into thinking you're terrible just when you're doing your best work. It's, self-doubt and sort of arrogance, you sort of swing wildly between the two, even on the same project. So, and you're almost always wrong about how it'll turn out.
Well, if you've deluded yourself about the worth of a project, would you want a friend to come in and say, John, this movie just isn't going to be any good?
No. Right. I want nothing but praise. actors know what I'm talking about.
Because if you don't get praise, you become insecure and can't function well?
I don't know. I guess I'm talking in terms of theater, where people come backstage right after you've performed, and about 20 hours before you have to do the same thing again. It's almost a conventional wisdom among actors. You find something positive to say when you come backstage, because I don't know, you're just so frail. Even the most secure and cocksure actor is ready to believe the worst about himself or what people think of him.
No, you were mentioning your father, who headed up several theater groups, including the McCarter Theater Company in Princeton. And your mother, I think, had been an actress, a retired actress. So I imagine there were lots of theater people around your house when you were growing up. Theater people are frequently more theatrical in real life than other people are. Just everything's just a little bigger than it would be for other people. And for some people, for some people who aren't in theater, that becomes really overbearing and hard to deal with. Mm-hmm. How did you react to being surrounded by theater people when you were a kid? Did you like that?
Oh, I loved it. Mm-hmm. I loved actors, and many of them I still work with and see and I have the same affection for them. I must say, I think because I grew up in that atmosphere, I was infatuated with the theater, but I didn't want to join in. I certainly knew an awful lot of embittered people in the theater, people who would get drunk at a cast party and say, "You don't want to get into this business," you know. I experienced quite a lot of that, and they were right to discourage me. I was going to be an artist. I wanted to somehow or other withstand the blandishments of theater, but I think it was my destiny. I went off to college and started doing college theatricals and quickly realized this was the thing I did best.
Well, after going to, I think, the Harvard Drama School, you went to the London Academy of Music and Dramatic Art.
Mm-hmm. And I didn't go to... There is no Harvard Drama School. I just went to
you
Harvard.
You just went to Harvard. Okay, and studied drama there.
No.
Studied painting there.
No, studied English, history, and literature.
Ah, okay.
Don't ask me why.
And don't quiz me on anything.
Right, God forbid.
When you went to London, were you... Did you get a very classical training there?
Very. I went... Lambda has this... wonderful one-year program called the D Group, which is for overseas students, most of them Americans. And it's like a very intense, condensed British academic acting education. And I sort of swallowed it whole. That and also seeing a lot of theater. I was there at a time when wonderful things were happening in British theater. And it was just... I came back, and as soon as I got rid of my unlooked for British accent, I was fine.
It seems to me that a lot of roles that you've gotten are the kinds of roles that wouldn't be offered the kind of actors who look like models. Do you know who have that, mm-hmm. that kind of the perfect good looks of whatever the period is?
Yeah.
Have you ever wanted those kinds of like perfect looks? Or do you think that that's really been a good break in a lot of ways because it enables you to play really interesting roles?
Well, I think it's a good break. I mean, I sort of am what I am. I don't regret, I don't much regret not being more handsome or, I think I'm a very odd assortment of characteristics. It's sort of, there's a lot of peculiarities and surprises about my body, my movements, my face, and I've just sort of learned to appreciate that. I'm sort of a surprising person, and I mean, as soon as I'm acting, I'm a surprising person. And I think the trick for an actor is to get to know himself very well, to get to know what his abilities are, what his both his limitations and his capacities are. And I've found that I've been able to sort of expand my horizons all the time. And I think that's just because I'm kind of an odd, eccentric person in physically and in other ways.
You have a couple of movies coming out?
Mm-hmm. One is called Out Cold, which is a sort of oddball black comedy about two butchers, Terry Garr and Randy Quaid, and Bruce McGill and I are in that. It's a murder comedy. And then a very serious father-son drama called Distant Thunder that Paramount is releasing in October. They couldn't be more different, these two movies, true to form.
Right. Well, I wish you the best, and I thank you so much for talking with us.
It was a real pleasure. I especially liked hearing myself.
it was really fun hearing you in those roles, and thanks so much for talking with us. Thank you. My guest has been John Lithgow, who's now starring in Broadway in the play M. Butterfly. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.